way of convincing the jury not to kill his client. It's easy to speculate what would have helped. What didn't was silence. But on punishment, the defense rested. Although this did not necessarily mean they'd given up on their client, a jury could easily assume they had. Even Lynch himself seemed taken aback, neglecting to ask the defendant if he agreed with this decision. In his journal, the judge would marvel at Sawyer's choice, especially because his client was 17 when the offense occurred, and in the 8 years since, had married, held a job, and stayed out of serious trouble. But Sawyer had been predicting the inevitability of a death sentence all day. When interviewed afterward, he'd tell reporters he couldn't imagine following up Bob Ayers' moving remembrances with a yes-but testimonial to their client's good character. At another time, he'd say Rob didn't want to involve his family in that mess he'd gotten himself into, and that he and Bettis respected that. He'd also call it strategy. Once the trial was over, Rob could request new counsel and a new trial, charging his attorneys with ineffective assistance of counsel, citing as proof the absence of mitigating testimony and the mistake of calling him to the stand. However the decision was made, there was no turning back. One member of the defense team simply said, "Sawyer messed up and he knows it." After a long lunch, Lynch read his charge to the jury, then went back over the special issues they were to consider and reminded them that the closing arguments were those of lawyers making a case, and if they felt unsure or conflicted on any point, they should trust the evidence they'd seen and heard. Each side got half an hour. Efren de la Fuente took the state's first 15 minutes, stressing the need for accountability, Springsteen's no-good life in the years since the murders, and the evil nature of the crime itself. "Hey, folks, they planned this thing out, knew what they were doing, didn't want to get caught, so burn the bodies." After re-emphasizing the Ayers' loss, he finished up by asking the jury to vote no to mitigating factors because Robert Springsteen ain't got no excuse for what he did. Sawyer alone presented the defense argument. He characterized Rob's lack of remorse as a sign of his innocence. At a moment when biblical references were in order, he spoke of mercy and the New Testament. He encouraged the jurors, even if they believed him guilty, to have the courage to spare his life. Once again, he chose brevity over persuasion. His argument took only 6 of his allotted 30 minutes. Robert Smith countered with graphic details. It took time to have those girls disrobe. It took time to tie them up and gag them. At any point along the way, Mr. Springsteen could go right out the door and not kill anybody. But that's not what he did. You have to realize that there are people in this world, and one of them is sitting right there, who will come up close to you and press the muzzle of a gun to your head and kill you. So that's the person we are talking about here. He has that core in him. To accompany his description of Springsteen shooting the wounded Amy Ayers in the head while she attempted to crawl away, he projected the photograph of Rob with his arm up, bent at the elbow, as he described how she was positioned. In the hall outside the courtroom, Sawyer told the statesman he thought his client would be sentenced to death, even though he was innocent, but that they would win the case on appeal. The jury asked for readbacks. Late in the afternoon, Lynch banged court into recess and everybody went home for the night, including the jury. The next afternoon, after 11 hours of deliberation, the bailiff informed the judge that the jury had come to a decision. Everybody filed back in, including the district attorney himself. While at least one juror wept, the foreman handed the decision to Lynch, who read it aloud. The jury had unanimously voted yes to continuing threat, no to mitigating factors, and yes to intentional murder. Following his mandate, Lynch imposed a sentence of death by lethal injection. Other jurors began to cry. The families of the girls linked arms. The APD officers in attendance tried to disguise their excitement. But Robert Smith and Ronnie Earle hung their heads, some thought to hide their response to a decision they'd worked to avoid by presenting the defendant with an offer they didn't think he'd refuse. Others disagree, having seen no sign of remorse in these two men's behavior. After Lynch informed Springsteen that a death sentence automatically guaranteed an appeal, which he would quickly set in motion, he thanked the jurors, attorneys, and spectators for their patience and cooperation, banged his gavel, and, court adjourned, swooped out. "This is not about killing Robert Springsteen," a sober Robert Smith maintained. Barbara Ayers Wilson said it wasn't that they wanted anybody to die. In years to come, however, she'd change her mind. "He got death," she told a reporter. "And we were happy about that. But it was still horrible. We were hoping to take someone else's life." Pam Ayers said they all needed some kind of ending. The next day, flanked by the girls' families, Ronnie Earle held a press conference. "This is," he said, "a somber occasion. We are doing our job, and we all together seek justice and truth." Rob's mother: "I still think it was a railroad job. I'm appalled." Bettis: "He's a proud man. He told the jury his story." When pressed by a reporter for an interview, one departing juror said, "Leave me alone. I've been through hell." Jury foreman Phil Rodriguez said, "I think our whole community will appreciate this being over." Lynch headed to Colorado for a fishing trip with his son. Among closing arguments in a capital case, perhaps the best known is the one given by Clarence Darrow in 1924, when the state of Illinois wanted to hang Richard Loeb and Nathan Leopold for the Chicago thrill killing of young Bobby Franks. Local response to what was called the crime of the century closely resembled Austin's reaction to the yogurt shop murders. The shocked city wanted an outcome. They wanted to understand, and they wanted blood. On the first day of the trial, as the prosecution honed its opening statement and the press settled in for a long, juicy trial, Darrow, who represented both defendants, surprised the state, the judge, and the world at large by issuing a last-minute guilty plea. The evidence against his clients was indisputable. If he couldn't protect the boys from a guilty verdict, he might at least be able to save their lives. Darrow's closing statement went on for a record 12.5 hours. It has many quotable passages, some of which are applicable to Springsteen. Here is one that emphasizes the young age of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, who were also teenagers at the time of the murder. "I know that these boys are not fit to be at large. I believe they will not be until they pass through the next stage of life at 45 or 50. I would not tell this court that I do not hope that sometime, when life and age has changed their bodies as it does, and has changed their emotions as it does, that they may once more return to life. I would be the last person on earth to close the door of hope to any human being that lives, and least of all to my clients." During his punishment argument, Sawyer had made a similar plea. "If you genuinely believe he did this, as I know you do, then tell me how important it is for him to, at some point in his life, discover what he has done." But Leopold and Loeb had entered a guilty plea, and they had Darrow, who directed his argument not to a jury, but a judge, who famously imposed a sentence of 99 years plus life. Scott. After Darla Davis read the grand jury indictment and Mike Scott's plea of not guilty was recorded, Robert Smith followed his Springsteen opener pretty closely. He honed it stylistically, leaning even more heavily on his habit of connecting terrible events with a repetitive, hypnotically understated conjunction. Something happened, and the ligature that was holding her hands together came loose, and the gag that was on her mouth came loose, and she fought and she tried to get away, and they subdued her. And this defendant used that sock gag as a ligature and choked her to death. And this defendant, Michael James Scott, shot her in the top of the head with a .22 caliber revolver. His statement went on much longer this time, well over an hour and a half, leading Lynch to call for a break before he'd finished. The defense attorneys divided their opening into three parts, Garcia first and last, Guilford in the middle. Carlos began with a thesis. This case is about one thing, the crime scene and the physical evidence. The two objective things leading to one real simple truth. Michael James Scott is innocent of this crime. Robert Springsteen is innocent. Forrest Wellborn is innocent, and Maurice Pierce is innocent. And while he intended to stay on point with that, he kept veering off into unmapped territory and then had to backtrack. Once he got to the Paul Johnson task force, he managed to return to his main strategy, emphasizing that everything that could be manipulated, changed, pressured, persuaded, even memories, discrepancies, and perceptions, had been. And for one purpose only, to make them fit this crime. He finished by reminding the jury that the prosecution's mandate was to prove guilt beyond reasonable doubt. Guilford's statement focused on the interrogation, covering false confessions, memory, coercive tactics, and time itself. More colloquial than Garcia, he addressed the jurors as friends and told them that, hey, he'd been a prosecutor himself down in Bayer County. He'd prosecuted criminal cases. He'd heard confessions. But what the state had here, he assured them, ain't a confession. Nearing the finish, he reminded the jury to watch the theory of memory that they posit to Mike over and over again. Just as sure as God made little green apples, that is not how our memory works. We do not have a VCR in our heads, and anybody that has studied it will tell you that. These are people who haven't studied memory one lick, but they convinced him of it. By this time, the two lawyers had gone on for 2.5 hours, with Garcia's finisher still to come. Lynch gave him half an hour, not a minute more, and when issued a 5-minute warning, he quickly summed up. They will do whatever it takes to make these boys fit. The truth is that when this thing is over, we are going to be able to prove what we said this afternoon. You are going to understand why there will be no conviction in this case. There will be no conviction, because if you are honest, and if you are an independent thinker, if you are objective, you will see. You will recognize reasonable doubt. You will see it. You will know it, because it's all over the place in this case. They'd gone on too long, and they knew it. 3 hours, Garcia says today. If we'd have been ready, we'd have finished in an hour. The girls' families will never forget one image he created that day. Describing the photos the jury would examine, Carlos said, "It was so hot in this area that that heat charred the body, sometimes splitting it. Much like if you put a hot dog on a skillet and you put the flame under the skillet and it blackens and it bursts open, that's what you are going to see." As one, the families recoiled at the insensitivity of this phrasing. "So," he says now, "after that, the families hated me. He regrets having made the remark, but knows that apologies will get him nowhere. We all make mistakes, he tells himself. Lynch thinks that while Carlos and Dexter were too long-winded and sometimes rambled far afield, they made sound points, and the prosecution knew it. The next morning, when Smith called his first witness, everybody in the courtroom, including the judge, expected Bob Ayers. Instead, he summoned Manuel Fuentes. This was not their original intent, Lynch wrote, and it took the defense by surprise. Everyone expected a more chronological approach, as in the first trial. When asked about this tactic, Efren de la Fuente smiled. We learned some things from the first trial, he said, and we wanted to start strong. A skeptical journalist thought this fairly represented Paul Johnson's investigative approach, putting final results first and letting the backup details follow. Fuentes read Scott's 8-page statement to the jury, and when asked to identify the person who made it, pointed out the defendant. Because the defense wasn't at all prepared for this strategy, Garcia's cross took up most of the afternoon. Noting the many discrepancies between Scott's written statement and the videotaped interrogation, he asked about a cutting knife Mike said he'd taken from the shop and thrown off a bridge, even though no knife had been mentioned in earlier statements and none had been reported missing. Did Fuentes know about that? He did not. And in the statement, Mike said he remembered what happened to the 380. This didn't appear in the videotape, nor did his erroneous description of the ICBY cash register drawer being lifted and slammed back, or his memory of shoving a paper towel into a girl's mouth. He also originally said the girls were naked when they were shot, then later remembered one of them wearing a white shirt. Was Mike given an opportunity to check the statement for mistakes? Yes, he went through each page, initialed corrections, and signed the statement in the presence of witnesses. These were excellent points, but Garcia's cross-examination had rambled and stuttered. We didn't have a choice, he explains without sounding defensive. We were figuring out what to do as we went along and had no choice but to cover every base, which meant we might get tedious and excessive. Scott opened on August 14, 2002, and would not end until September 24th, making it the longest-running criminal trial in Travis County history. Lynch cast most of the blame for this on the defense's excruciatingly tedious and often repetitive cross-examinations. After Fuentes, the prosecution returned to chronology. The girls, the crime, the investigation. Bob Ayers, Barbara Ayers Wilson, James and Maria Thomas, Sam Buchanan, Troy Gay, Garza, DeVoe, Pennington. The next day, Irma Rios, Reese Price, Melvin Stahl, Marshall Littleton, the fingerprint expert Rachel Riffey, the medical examiner Dr. Tommy Brown. Garcia did particularly well dismantling Reese Price's testimony about the lock on the back door, especially after she identified the photograph of an obviously new device as the one that had been in the door on the night of the murders. Was she sure? Positive. Carlos pointed out that the lock was brand new, whereas the only close-up photo taken that night showed one that was scarred and dull. In addition, the brass plate on the inside of the door had unusual scratches and gouges, perhaps having been damaged by a screwdriver or crowbar. Could the killers have perhaps become stuck in the back room? Did they have to pry open the back door? Did she know of anybody else using a crowbar? She couldn't say. Bottom line, he reminded her, the original lock had been lost. And nobody even remembered what kind of lock it was, right? And so there was no way of knowing whether or not Rob Springsteen had wedged the door open, or if it had remained locked until the killers forced it open, right?
Right.
a productive, if costly, cross-examination. Although Price's perfect certainty had been slightly dislodged, Garcia had again gone on far too long. As one juror told a newspaper reporter, "I thought if I heard one more word about that backdoor lock, I would scream." Ironically, one detail that went unmentioned was the receipt from Cothran's safe and lock for that new lock and bolt, which had been purchased for $28.52 on December 7th by Jesse Vasquez and charged to APD homicide. Garcia didn't forget about it. The receipt had not been given to either defense team. Melvin Stahl returned to give his change-of-heart testimony about the origin of the fire. On cross, Garcia pushed him hard. His conclusion of December 7, 1991, was that the fire appeared to have originated somewhere off the floor, maybe on the second shelf next to the south wall, near Jennifer Harbison's body, yes? Yes. And he'd stuck with that conclusion from 1991 until he retired in 1997, and in all that time, none of the other arson investigators he'd met with had questioned it, correct? Yes. How many times had he met with them? 5 times, maybe 10. Then 1999 rolled around, and Paul Johnson wanted him to talk to a person named Marshall Littleton, right? Stahl couldn't remember who had called him. His report says it was somebody from the DA's office. And he met with Littleton and at first refused to change his opinion, correct? Yes. And again, that meeting occurred in October 1999, maybe on the 14th. He didn't recall the exact date, but that was close. And that was just after the police had gotten Mike to agree that he'd set these girls on fire, correct? Stahl believed it was. And by then, there was also an 8-page statement Mike had signed saying he'd piled the girls up and poured Zippo lighter fluid on them and lit it, right? Stahl hadn't read the confession. Then he met with Marshall Littleton again, true? Yes. And his conclusions changed? After viewing photographs and reading additional reports, yes. Even though he was there on December 7th, 1991, and Littleton was not, even though Littleton never saw what he'd seen with his own eyes, even though Littleton knew only what Paul Johnson had told him. No response. Mr. Stahl, in your opinion, as of December 7th, 1991, was the likely source of origin of that fire somewhere along those shelves? That is correct. After more fire testimony from Marshall Littleton, followed by the ME's presentation of autopsy reports, photographs and styrofoam heads with rods poked through to demonstrate the path of the projectiles, the state was ready to show the videotapes. Smith called Ron Latta. Once again, the jury had been given transcripts. Garcia's objection overruled. Lynch issued instructions and the lights dimmed and the tape ran. White room, white table, Latta, Hardesty, ponytailed Mike. On and on. By Thursday, August 29th, a weary Lynch asked Darla Davis how many more of these things there were. The final tape ran that day. During the next few days, the prosecution called Robert Springsteen III, who again didn't remember calling Teleserve, and then Marianne Heskey, who recalled that he had. Then Kelly Hanna, Amanda Statham, her sister Sarah, and their mother. On cross, Amanda said that when Mike told her he'd killed the girls, the whole world sunk in on me. But when Garcia reminded her that she'd said nothing of Mike's confession until after his arrest, Statham simply said, "Correct." On September 4th, Chandra Morgan returned, this time to testify that the .380 was tucked into the waistband of Mike's jeans, not Rob's. She'd also been brought up to speed on the make and model of Maurice's car. During cross, Guilford asked detailed questions about her previous version of the night's events, her heroin addiction, and her 10-hour session with APD officers after the arrests. Once again, the loopy Morgan proved less than helpful to the state's case. The prosecution revisited ballistics, unidentified hairs, mitochondrial DNA, and Johnny Holder's sale of the .22 to Maurice Pierce. Lucella Jones described what it was like to view the lineup photos, and APD Sergeant Bruce Boardman presented a sketchy account of his 1991 interviews with Scott and Springsteen. On Friday, September 6th, after many contentious exchanges and at least one defense motion for mistrial, Lynch characterized the afternoon recess as a ceasefire. The prosecution would close on Wednesday. That gave Guilford and Garcia extra time to update their files in preparation for the state's final witnesses and to refine their own. At one point, Carlos told the judge he didn't know how he'd be able to finish this friggin' case. The next day, Lynch wrote in his journal that, "We're now over 3 weeks into the trial. It has been extremely slow going, with the tension between the attorneys and sometimes between attorneys and me." They'd already heard more than 50 witnesses, and the state wouldn't rest until 2 days later. He didn't recall a case, he noted, with so many close and often novel questions to be decided. And Scott was even tougher than Springsteen because the defense lawyers were anal retentive on questions relating to evidence and the law. Plus, they had the benefit of having reviewed the record from Springsteen. Also, he wrote, "They have constantly pushed the envelope on cross-examination, often well past proper outer limits." In addition to standard and not-so-standard objections, he'd had to deal with suggestive photo spreads, relevance of co-defendants' acts loosely connected to but not part of the murders, prior consistent statements used to rehabilitate a witness, questions of hearsay, and more complex backdoor hearsay, admissibility of statements made as part of standard jailbooking procedures, admissibility of statements casually made to jail guards and others I've already lost track of. When the time came to present Springsteen's West Virginia statement, the prosecution called Merrill. Because Rob hadn't signed anything, Lynch had ordered the state to paraphrase his videotaped confession in some 10 to 15 sentences to be read aloud in no more than 5 minutes. As in Springsteen, the defendant's name would be redacted. But before Merrill could reach the stand, Garcia rose to hotly object to every line of the prepared summary. Overruled. Holding a single sheet of paper, Merrill entered the witness box. The first part of his testimony was standard setup. Who was there, how the clock camera worked, how long the interview lasted, at what point the Nagra tape ran out, what they did to assure Mr. Springsteen he was not in custody. Satisfied he'd covered due process requirements, Smith asked Merrill if Mr. Springsteen had admitted participation in the yogurt shop murders, to which Merrill replied, "Yes, sir." And when Smith asked what exactly the suspect had said, Merrill read this. "He originally said that he did not know about the murders, did not even know they had occurred, until he had been interviewed by the police. As the interview continued, he remembered he bought a newspaper and read it in a stolen Pathfinder on the way to San Antonio. During the interview, Robert Springsteen admitted involvement in the murders by telling us that he went into the yogurt shop prior to the robbery and opened the back door so he had a way to get in. Robert Springsteen said he went through the front door, then went to the bathroom. Robert Springsteen said when no one was looking, he unlocked and opened the back door. Robert Springsteen said he propped it open by using a folded pack of cigarettes or a rock to keep the door from shutting all the way, saying it wasn't noticeable unless you were looking right at it. Robert Springsteen said at some point in time he went back that evening. He said he went through the back door. Robert Springsteen said there was a silver 380 automatic handgun used in the yogurt shop. Robert Springsteen said he raped a girl, stated he did not think he ejaculated. He said he shot a girl in the back of the head with the 380 as she was crawling, screaming, and crying. He demonstrated the position that Amy Ayers died, which was the position we found her in after the fire was extinguished. Robert Springsteen talked about hearing a total of 5 shots, maybe 6, but remembered 5. And after the robbery, Robert Springsteen said he left the yogurt shop, went to a bridge where he got out of the car and threw up. Then he ended the interview before we were complete. After a few more quick questions, Robert Smith passed the witness to Garcia, who was intense and intelligent, but as always, Merrill took the heat with equanimity. When asked if, in fact, the interrogation segment of an interview wasn't a fact-finding expedition, but an accusatory one, the unruffled cop said he would think that was correct, yes. When asked why police found it necessary to question a suspect in a controlled face-to-face environment, Merrill replied, "Well, you can look at him, read his body, how he's answering, what he's saying, because you're thinking ahead of him. You're thinking behind him." Garcia, "You think he did it, don't you?" Merrill, "Yes, sir." On redirect, Smith pushed for the admission of a still photo taken from the Springsteen videotape, even though the two sides had agreed that no pictures from the interrogation would be shown. Garcia strenuously objected, but was overruled, and the clip of Rob demonstrating the position of Amy Ayers' body appeared on the screen. On Wednesday, September 11th, the state rested its case, and Lynch called for the defense. Garcia's strategy diverged considerably from Sawyer's. "There was no way to win taking that tack," Carlos says now, "and that if nobody was prepared to investigate a homicide like this, so what? So they didn't do a great job with the evidence. So DPS blew it, so what? John Jones did the best he could with what he had. We can talk about that forever, but what's to gain for our client?" Instead, the Scott defense attacked what Garcia calls the Paul Johnson Show's back engineering, in which the detective came up with a scenario he liked and then did whatever it took to pile up a case around it to make it workable enough to sell. To shore up that theory and prove how many other people knew what Mike and Rob had done, and therefore might well have ended up at the top of Johnson's pyramid of guilt themselves, the two lawyers had submitted requests for some of the 1992 confessions. Saavedra and Cortez, Alex Briones and Sean Smith, among others. And they dug up media stories, looking for quotes, leaks, and rumors that might have fed Mike Scott's imagination with scraps of information he eventually became convinced were his own. They would call expert witnesses who could explain how memory really worked and how and why false confessions sometimes occurred. They began by returning to the crime scene. Questioning firefighters, they made quick jumps from that night's play-by-play to what they were really after. Information about visits Hardesty and other cops had made after the arrests, and the answers the firefighters had given them about whom they might have told what they'd seen. Most said they'd described certain details, the ice scoop, the number of victims, the position of the bodies, who was burned the worst, what the place looked like, to wives or other firefighters. One said he'd told his wife about the bodies of 3 of the victims being stacked in the rear of the business and about Amy Ayers' location. Another remembered saying that the precise piles of clothing meant that the disrobing must have taken a long time. But the court ruled that without first-hand knowledge, these witnesses could not speculate how far their news might have traveled beyond their immediate circle, so the lawyers had to hope jurors would make that leap on their own. Then the defense brought back Reese Price and Amy Dreiss, the ICBY workers, Jorge Barney from the party house, an FBI ballistics expert, and two of Mike's friends. The next day, they called on John Jones to read Sean Smith's confession, and on Mike Huckabee to read Alex Briones's. Manuel Fuentes again acknowledged that he hadn't reviewed the videotapes, and Guilford himself took the stand to read a summary the defense had put together of the numerous crime scene details reported by the Statesman. Afterward, outside the jury's presence, there was a storm of disagreements as both sides and the judge argued about the importance of tips and rumors. Every time the defense asserted its need to further pursue the possibility that Mike Scott had derived many of his so-called memories from information on the street and in the newspapers, the state shouted, "Irrelevant." Exchanges grew spiky. Once Garcia insulted Lynch, Guilford took over and touched on several instances that two of the girls were stacked in a certain way and one was separate from the others, that one girl was choked and strangled, that money was left in the cash register, that the girls were tied up with their own underwear, and other bits of information that were every bit as accurate as Mike Scott's. Late one afternoon after the jury had been dismissed, Guilford previewed for Lynch and the prosecution the testimony they expected to hear from their first expert witness, Richard Leo, the next morning. At the time, only criminologists and attorneys knew who Leo was, but in the next few years he would become widely known, having co-authored The Wrong Guys, False Confessions, and The Norfolk Four, a book about four U.S. Navy sailors who, under intense police pressure and without any forensic evidence tying them to the crime, confessed one by one, in domino fashion, to a 1997 rape and murder they didn't commit. Three were tried and convicted. The fourth pleaded guilty. All four went to Virginia State Prison until DNA results and a more cogent confession revealed the identity of the real killer rapist. They were released but not exonerated, which means that to this day they live as legally designated sex offenders and murderers. The New Yorker and PBS's Frontline coverage would feature Richard Leo. Explaining why they'd chosen him, Guilford reminded Lynch that when jury panelists were asked if they could imagine confessing to a crime they didn't commit, the answer was a nearly unanimous no. And if the defense was to prove its main premise that Mike Scott did exactly that, the jury needed to hear a sound theory based on case studies and an anecdotal explanation of how this counterintuitive thing could happen. Guilford did a good job describing Leo's expertise, but the judge wasn't sold. False confession was one thing. What he didn't like was testimony aimed at drawing conclusions about the effect of coercive questioning on a potential suspect. And as Guilford struggled to make his case, Lynch's questions became edgier. Like many judges, Mike Lynch harbored a faint distrust of expert witnesses, considering them hired guns, often academics flown in to lecture the rubes. And while he recognized the importance of specialized knowledge, he was inclined to get touchy when a witness produced anecdotes and called them science. Soft science was as far as he'd go. Thinking people, he maintained, had their own specialized knowledge and didn't need somebody like the alleged false confession expert Richard Leo from Berkeley to help them draw conclusions. What's also pretty clear is that, unfortunately for the defense, Lynch couldn't get past Leo's close association with Richard Offshey. Guilford handled the judge well having a quicker instinct for deference than Garcia. And the prosecution said they had no problem acknowledging that false confessions existed, but as they'd already made clear, they strongly objected to the need for an expert and would hold out against Leo's appearance for as long as it took. Lynch requested case law and more information. The defense provided 200 pages of Leo's testimony in another case, as well as a number of articles and examples of case law on false confessions, suggestibility, and the effect of police interrogation tactics on decision-making. Labeling Leo's field of expertise junk science, the prosecution presented Lynch with their articles and examples of case law. The defense also wanted to call a memory specialist. Their first choice, Elizabeth Loftus, who'd written highly respected books on the subject, had to cancel at the last minute, and so they'd turned to Robert Schomer. Lynch agreed to study the Leo information that night and would hear arguments for and against admitting the two experts the next day. The exhausted lawyers finally left the courthouse at 7:30 that night, but the judge headed back to his office. Taking to his couch, he began reading. At 10, he drove to a nearby 24-hour diner, and, over a late meal, kept reading. At home, he reviewed the prosecution's transcripts and articles. Obviously, Leo was prepared to tell the jury not just how false confessions occurred, but also why a person who'd given one didn't quickly recant, as most of us would expect. Sometimes, he maintained, the suspect remained in a post-admission narrative of guilt despite being convinced of his innocence. A theory that would give the defense room to explain why Mike Scott kept going back to be interviewed. The Supreme Court had set the standard for the admission of expert witnesses in the 1993 decision on Daubert v. Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals, Inc., in which it established four criteria of reliability: testing, peer review, error rates, and acceptability in the relevant scientific community. As gatekeeper of those standards, Lynch struggled. Ordinarily, he wrote, I might let it all come in, just to be sure I give the defense every opportunity to develop a full and proper defense. He also wanted to make sure they got every legitimate dollar's worth out of the experts they'd hired. But this one rubbed him the wrong way. He didn't want to give the Berkeley professor a stage on which to parade opinions supporting what Lynch believed was his obvious agenda, to change police interrogation tactics. The judge lost a lot of sleep trying to figure out an honest reflection of the state of the law as best as he could determine it. But he still had questions. Whatever you do in these tough situations, he wrote, there is always residual doubt, guilt, and second-guessing. The next morning, outside the jury's presence, he swore in the two experts. Richard Leo went first, and unlike Offshee, he wore his expertise lightly. On the stand, he identified himself as a criminologist and social psychologist whose specialty was the study of, quote, coercive persuasion or extreme influence in decision-making. In other words, how an individual makes decisions in a high-pressure environment. He described modern interrogation techniques as psychological methods meant to shape and change a suspect's perceptions and to convince him that the most rational and sensible decision, given what the interrogator is telling him and what he has come to believe, is to say, "Okay, you're right, I did it, now can I go home?" He went on to explain the basic methods, again read, used in the Scott interrogation. In order to create a context for their strategies, by first accusing the suspect of lying, and then attacking his denials and his belief in the reliability of his memory, Lotta and the others had created a situation in which the suspect could lose only by denying his culpability. Not everybody could be broken in this manner, but it did happen. In time, some people came to think they might have committed the crime without remembering the act itself. And then, isolated, alone, with no outside support to urge them to quit talking, they began to speculate, guess, imagine, toss out possibilities, incorporating street rumors as well as information from the press. They might even look to their interrogators for answers. Garcia then took on memory expert Robert Schomer, who provided a long list of credentials, publications, and research studies. He proposed to first discuss how memory worked, and then to gauge the validity of theories held by polygraphers and the police. Schomer had seen the videotapes of Scott's interrogation. He had also read the transcripts. The defense plan was to present video clips, the one in which Bruce Stevenson gave Scott his memory as VCR lesson, the trance induction of Sal Abreu, the visualization exercise, so that Schomer could refute the hypotheticals. Robert Smith acknowledged the probable reliability of Schomer's expertise, but didn't see the need to show video clips, since the jury had already seen the tapes. At one point, when Garcia disingenuously asked Smith which evidence they were prepared to admit, Lynch curtly pointed out that he was the one to decide, not the prosecution. Lynch ruled that Schomer could talk about how memory worked and how persuasion and suggestion might encourage people to remember things that didn't happen. No video clips. As for Leo, he could talk about decision-making under pressure and how people decided to confess to crimes they didn't commit, but he would not be allowed to discuss persuaded false confessions or post-admission narratives. Considering Daubert and his own conscience, the judge had decided that while false confessions did occur, Leo's theory that police interrogation tactics caused regular folks to believe they were guilty of crimes they hadn't committed was pure guesswork. Guilford protested. The entire case against their client was based on an interrogation the defense believed was coercive. To take away the information Leo could provide, with backup support from case studies, wrongful convictions, exonerations, and other criminal trials, would gut their defense. When Lynch wouldn't budge, Guilford threw in the towel. Fine, then, they wouldn't call Leo at all. As lead counsel, Garcia didn't have to go along with this, but by then, both men were pretty used up, and he didn't challenge Guilford's decision. Later, he admitted he should have pulled rank and convinced Dexter to take what they could get, but he didn't. And so Richard Leo headed back to California that afternoon, as the prosecution had hoped. Lynch considers Richard Leo a smart man who's doing important work, and thinks that, even hobbled by his decision, his testimony could have helped the defense. But he stands by his ruling. Based on all the literature he could absorb that night, he believes the witness was prepared to venture past the outer limits of good science into conjecture, speculation, and what he thought sometimes happened. After the jury was seated, Schomer testified as expected, and afterward the defense called Paul Johnson again to ask him about phone interviews he'd had with Scott in 1998, and the conversations he'd had with Chandra Morgan before the four boys were arrested, in which she told many stories about the night of the murders, but never once mentioned Springsteen, Scott, or the other two, and never said anything about going to the yogurt shop that afternoon. The last defense witness of the day was APD polygrapher Bruce Stevenson, whose revivification theory had been pretty much obliterated, not just by Schomer, but also by ordinary common sense. The defense had two more expert witnesses to present on Thursday. Smith wanted to schedule closing arguments the following day, but Garcia asked that they wait until Monday, giving them the weekend to work on theirs. Lynch, his patience frayed, preferred Friday, but there was a potential problem. On Saturday, the University of Texas Longhorns were playing a home game, and football being the great Texas pastime, he wasn't sure he could find motel space for the jurors that night. He'd have to check. Known as Bloodstain Pattern Analyst, BPA, and Crime Scene Reconstructionist, CSR, job titles familiar to fans of The Closer and the CSI series, the defense's next-to-last expert witness, Ross Martin Gardner, had worked in federal law enforcement for 29 years before taking over a small metropolitan department in suburban Atlanta as chief of police. After that, instead of retiring, he got into forensics, studied at Scotland Yard, became active in the International Association of Bloodstain Pattern Analysts, took thousands of hours of technical training, wrote articles on crime scene analysis and reconstruction, and became, in time, a nationally recognized expert. After establishing these credentials, Garcia asked Gardner to tell the jury what crime scene reconstructionists did. The job, as he described it, was one of simple logic and deduction using the scientific method. They gathered evidence, examined every available piece, and explored the relationship between these items. For example, in Yogurt Shop, one piece of evidence was the phone receiver found hanging from the melted body of the telephone. Why was it off the hook? Phone records revealed that no outgoing calls were made after the shop closed. A reasonable assumption would be an interrupted call, perhaps one of the girls attempting to call 911 when someone took control of the receiver or forced her to drop it. We take pieces of physical evidence, we put them in as much order as possible, and when we're done, what we have is a skeleton. Pieces that fit in a certain order. In 1988, Gardner had taken a course from the defense's next expert, Tom Bevel, the country's leading blood spatter analyst. Before long, they joined forces and developed a method of teaching what they'd learned to cops, private investigators, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and whoever else wanted to know. In 1997, after co-authoring Bloodstain Pattern Analysis with an Introduction to Crime Scene Reconstruction, they expanded their teaching into a business. Operating out of Bevel's home state of Oklahoma, Bevel, Gardner, and Associates was soon scheduling seminars all over the country. In the next 15 years, they hired many more consultants and teachers, most of them retirees from law enforcement. Ironically enough, in December of 2000, during Yogurt Shop pre-trials, when the state was working hard to match crime scene evidence with details of the co-defendant's confessions, Tom Bevel had been hired by the Travis County DA's office to, in his words, examine documentation relative to Amy Ayers' death and to try to identify the most probable sequence of events relative to the physical evidence surrounding her body. It was Efren De La Fuente who had made contact with Bevel and subsequently sent photographs, diagrams, and the autopsy report. The package included no photographs of the storage room, the doors, the front room, or the other girls. Bevel studied the material, and in April 2001, when Springsteen was getting underway, submitted his findings. The only response he got was a letter from De La Fuente saying he might be called as a witness. He'd heard nothing more. Those findings have never been made public. As requested, Carlos had sent Gardner a notebook filled with the original incident reports, autopsy, and private lab DNA reports, crime scene and autopsy photographs, and the conflicting arson conclusions. What Gardner specifically did not want were statements, whether from suspects, witnesses, or the victims' families. It didn't matter what the victims had done that afternoon, or what people who'd been to the shop remembered. He wanted only physical evidence and first-hand official reports. He'd even made a trip to Austin to view and take his own pictures of items stored in the APD evidence room in order to follow a basic process of crime scene analysis and crime scene reconstruction. If this sounds at once sensible and somewhat oversimplified, it is both. Though if the success of the Bevel-Gardner partnership points out anything, it's that there are gaping holes in the forensic capabilities of police departments all across the country. That cops aren't scientists goes without saying, but it's also important to understand that they're local. Their job requires them to respond not just to their chief, but also to the DA and the mayor, as well as, in a high-profile case like Yogurt Shop, to the families of the victims and a clamoring public. And then there are the inevitable skirmishes and power plays within any homicide department. Ideally, an outsider can provide a more balanced response. Gardner might have gone on too long from time to time, but his was probably the most interesting and most nearly objective account of the Yogurt Shop crime scene that anybody had offered thus far. Having been prepped on Lynch's attitudes, he described the Reconstructionist's methodology as scientific and objective. "We're not guessing," he told the judge. "We're not going, well, I kind of have a gut feeling." On the contrary, they looked for defined events that occurred during the incident, each of which they listed as a specific event segment. Because their arson expert had canceled his appearance, the defense also depended on Gardner to talk about fire origin and cause. Although he wasn't an expert on software modeling, he'd studied fire science and was certain that the evidence showed that the girls' bodies suffered direct burns from falling ceiling tiles. The records and photographs showed no evidence of napkins or cups on or about the bodies, nor the use of an accelerant. Garcia also wanted Gardner to present a flow chart comparing the videotaped and written statements of Michael Scott, noting the consistencies and inconsistencies between them. But De La Fuente objected. "An expert witness could not testify to the credibility of a witness, particularly the defendant on trial." To refute this objection, Guilford cited Texas Rule of Evidence 704, which allowed expert testimony on an ultimate issue, in this instance, guilt or innocence. Objection overruled. After warning the witness not to tell the jury how to perform its function, Lynch ruled that if Gardner stuck to specific statements by the defendant, compared them to specific findings he'd made, and rendered an opinion only on whether or not that statement was consistent with his findings, he could be of assistance to the jury. He could not, however, make direct suggestions about the defendant's credibility. Gardner agreed to comply. The defense next called Tom Bevel, aiming to show that the APD and the prosecution weren't after the truth, but a confirmation of the case they'd built. Garcia asked immediately about the consultation Bevel had made in December 2000. When on cross, De La Fuente accused him of claiming scientific certainty for his conclusions, Bevel didn't bite. "All scientists," he said, including himself, were wary of making claims of certainty. Later that afternoon, when De La Fuente recalled Gardner, his questioning was sharp, but his dependence on sarcasm often led him to make charges he had to back away from. Gardner remained calm, answered his questions, and certainly earned the fee he'd been paid. Though the jurors didn't buy everything he said, he might well have planted seeds of doubt in their minds. To emphasize once again that by early 1992, information about Yogurt Shop was floating freely throughout the city, especially among young people, the defense had hoped to bring in a man named Aaron Chadwick, who'd been interviewed then by both Hector Polanco and John Jones. But the pierced and tattooed Chadwick seemed to have vanished. All they had was an email address, and he wasn't answering. Maybe they